morning.
All right, if you haven't turned to Genesis 12, please go ahead and do so. We're going to be looking there in the first three verses today as we talk about Abraham and how Abraham was a man of obedience. So we'll be thinking about what obedience means this morning as we look at his life. You know, Abraham was a lot of things. You know, he's called a man of faith in the Scriptures. He's called a friend of God. He's obviously a man who was the recipient of a whole lot of promises given to him by God. But the Scriptures also refer to him as a man who obeyed over and over and over and over. We read in the Old Testament and the New that this characterized him as a person. He was an obedient man. In the Scriptures that Kevin read for us this morning in Genesis 22, you know, right after the sacrifice of Isaac's story happens, God reaffirmed his promises to Abraham and said, because you obeyed me, I'm going to pour out everything I promised. In Genesis 26, in 4 and 5, in the time of Isaac, there was a big famine, and God told him, don't go to Egypt because there's a famine and there's not a lot of food around here. I'll take care of you. And then he talked about his dad. You know, Abraham obeyed me. And so the implication, you need to obey me too, like your father did. In Hebrews 11, verse 8, that Kevin read, Hebrew writer, one of the things he focuses on with Abraham's life is he obeyed. When God gave Abraham a direction to go, Abraham went, regardless of whether he really understood everything that was going on, or regardless of whether he personally felt comfortable in that situation or not, regardless of whether he thought it was difficult or easy, he obeyed God's decisions. And so I'm very struck by his story. I'm excited about it, and I hope that it's helpful for you as we go through his life this morning to look at how he obeyed God. All right, let's look at Genesis 12 together and read the first three verses. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you and curse, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Now this was despite the fact that in Hebrews 11 verse 8, we're specifically told by the Hebrew writer that Abraham didn't have the foggiest idea of where he was going. You know, in Genesis 12, God's pretty sparse on the details here. He just says, I'm going to make you a great name, and I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to give you this land, and you're going to bless all the nations, but you need to go. You just need to go. Now, Abraham had a pretty nice setup in the city of Ur. We know from archaeology that Ur was a really nice place to live. But God just said, without any specific instructions about where he was going, just said, leave. Pack up what you got, put it in the U-Haul, or the donkeys and the camels, and get out of there. Now, let's just say that somebody instructed you, I want you to go and move internationally to some faraway country. Wouldn't you feel really uncomfortable about that if no specific guidelines were given to you? Wouldn't you need to know what the housing situation is like in this far-off country? Wouldn't you need to know some details about food, what the grocery stores are like, how you would go to the market and buy clothing, what the population and the culture is like? What's the weather like? Is there a monsoon season or not? How do I prepare for this? How do I make sure that I am fully engaged in this? You know, is Amazon.com available to me? You know, a lot of important details need to go into moving. And so if I were Abraham, I could see myself trying to press God for more specifics. You know, so you say you're going to bless me, and you're going to bless my family, and we're going to bless the nations. How does that happen? Where are we going? What land is this that that you are instructing us to do this? What about my wife? She hasn't had any children, God, for our entire marriage, and you say that you're going to make a nation from us? What about the land that you're wanting to give to us? What if our land is already inhabited by other people? How is that going to work? Are you going to kick them out or not? There's so many questions that he could have pressed God for the answers to, but he didn't. And he didn't understand many of the details at all, but he still left. He chose to obey, and even when he died, even at the end of Abraham's life, he still didn't know all the answers to these questions. But he died in faith, knowing that God is always faithful to what he promises to do. Now, how do we apply this to us? Think about how children are instructed by God to obey their parents. You know, in Ephesians chapter 6, in verse 1, God says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." Those of you who are younger and you're still living at home, let me ask you this question. At what point should you obey your parents? Is it the point where you understand all the details of what you're instructed to do? Is it the point where you agree completely with what your parents are instructing you to do? Maybe they tell you to do some kind of chore, and you're thinking, "Well, I've got plenty of brothers and sisters who can handle that." But and also, why do I have to obey now? Why can't I do it in an hour or two? Why do I have to do it in the way that Mom and Dad said? I know a better way to handle that problem or that issue or that thing that they're wanting me to do. Now, you can still obey even if you don't have all the details, even if you don't completely understand, because that's what Abraham did. You know, we can think about how this applies to our relationship with the elders of this church. You know, Hebrews 13 and verse 17 says, "Obey your leaders and submit to them, for they are keeping watch over your souls," speaking about our relationship with our elders. You know, in that Hebrews passage, we don't read, "Obey and submit to these leaders only if you completely understand all the decisions that they make, all the reasons for which that went into making their decisions. Only if you completely agree with what they do." You know, what if you bring a complaint or an issue or something that you're wondering about to Mo and Wally, and they hear you out on it, and they take some time to search the scriptures about what you have said, and then they come back to you and they say, "This is the wisdom from God in our best judgment. This is what we believe you should do. This is the direction we believe you should head in this issue." At what point will we follow their lead? God didn't give all the details to Abraham, but that didn't affect Abraham's decision to obey the instructions that he was given. All right, let's go back to Genesis and go to chapter 17, if you would, please, and let's read about some further obedience on Abraham's part. Genesis 17, beginning verse 15. "And God said to Abraham, 'As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall become nations. Kings, a people shall come from her.' Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said to himself, 'Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? Shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?' And Abraham said to God, 'Oh, that Ishmael might live before you.' God said, 'No, but Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac.'" Now, Abraham and Sarah have been waiting for a child since chapter 12, when God gave the original promise to make him a great nation, to bless all the nations through his offspring. Abraham and Sarah have been figuring out how that's going to happen. You know, in Genesis 12, he was 75, she was 65. When we get over to chapter 17, 25 years have gone by. He's now a really old man. He's now 100 years old. And now she's 90. And Abraham, after he hears what God has brought to his attention, that it's not going to be through Hagar, it's not going to be through Ishmael, it's not going to be through Eleazar of Damascus, that distant relative that Abraham talks to God about in chapter 15. God says, no, it's not going to be through any of those options. It's going to be through your wife, your first wife, Sarah. Now, this is actually the very first time in all of God's revelations to Abraham. This is the first time where he gets this specific about where this child of promise is going to come from. And Abraham's reaction in verse 17 is to fall down laughing. And in the next chapter, when Sarah herself hears about how this is going to happen, she has the same reaction. She laughs. And she gets in trouble for that. But both of them, they think this is impossible. This doesn't happen to 100-year-olds and 90-year-olds. But because Abraham was a man of obedience, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 12 says, this happens, therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born descendants as many as the stars of heaven and as many as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. Abraham obeyed, even though God's promises seemed very laughable to him. So how about us? Do God's promises ever seem really outlandish, really impossible, not very realistic? And you think about what God says about the resurrection from the dead. Now, as our bodies age, as they decline in health, as we grow older and older and older throughout our years, despite medicine's attempts to keep us propped up, it might seem unrealistic to read scriptures about how God's going to take this physical body that gets old and decrepit, and he's going to raise it up, take it out of the grave, and transform it into something glorious. That doesn't seem very realistic when we're looking around at our wrinkles and our sags. But 1 Corinthians 15 very clearly says God is going to do this. You know, sometimes people think that in the first century, people were so gullible, and they just believed anything. So, oh, Jesus rose from the dead. Yeah, sure he did. Let's get on board with that. How naive, you know, modern-day scientists say. And yet, even people in the first century, especially Greeks, thought that the resurrection from the dead was insane. In Greek philosophy, if you die and your soul leaves your body, your soul doesn't want to come back. Once you're free from your body, that's it. You're done. You don't want a resurrection. That's laughable to the Greeks' way of thinking about the world. And yet Paul, in 1 Corinthians 15, had to deal with some Christians who had already obeyed the gospel who thought that the resurrection was foolishness. And so he writes this whole chapter there about how it is going to happen, because God's promised to do it. What about our sins? Does it ever seem laughable to us or unrealistic to us when we read these really clear scriptures about how when we obey the gospel, God takes us, our souls, and he washes us as white as snow, as Isaiah 1 talks about? He also promises in 1 John chapter 1 to make our souls clean during our Christian journey on this earth. And that's how he's going to look at us when we are in the blood of his Son. Does that seem realistic when we go back and we think in our memories about past sins that we have on our records, that we remember committing? I don't know about you, but I have a long list of sins that I have done that are burns on my mind and in my memory that I cannot fully wipe out. And even now, I have character traits about myself that I hate, that I battle on a continual basis. And yet Jesus says that He, even now, as I'm living my life, can wash me clean. That does not make sense to me at some points in my life. And maybe that's your situation too. But here's the question that we're faced with. Will we still obey? Will we still say, I believe in your promises that you look at me as clean, even though I look at myself and I don't see a lot of cleanness? Do we still obey the gospel and trust in the blood of Jesus? Abraham obeyed, even though it didn't make sense. It seemed almost funny to him that God would do something like this and give Isaac to him through Sarah. All right, something else that we notice about Abraham's obedience is that he did not delay in doing it. Go to chapter 22 of Genesis, if you would, please. Chapter 22 takes place after, much later than the point where he gets Isaac and he is born to him. Genesis 22, verse 1, after these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son, Isaac. Now, he has another son, Ishmael, but this is the only son of promise that the promises are going to come from. Take your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham waited a week. Abraham waited a month. Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. If God instructed you to take the son that you have been waiting for 25 years and to take him up on a mountain and take a knife and slit his throat and kill him and offer him up as a burnt offering to God, how would you react to that situation? What do you think Abraham should have done after receiving this command? Do you think it would make sense if he took time to absorb the gravity of the situation? The fact that he would have to offer Isaac up? He didn't wait in this situation, because we're told in Hebrews 11 that Abraham believed that God had the power to resurrect his son. And we're given a hint of that in chapter 22, verse 5, where Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come to you again. Abraham's not having a moment of amnesia where he just forgets that he's going to have to kill his son. He believes his son is coming back alive in this situation. He doesn't hesitate at all in his obedience. And so how does this, again, impact our lives? You know, in the Sunday morning class, we're studying the book of 1 Peter. And very quickly, we're going to get to chapter 3, which talks in great detail about the relationship between husbands and wives. And it's interesting, in 1 Peter 3, examples are brought up of the relationship between Abraham and his wife Sarah. And I'd like to go over to 1 Peter 3 and read part of those scriptures with you. 1 Peter 3, verse 1, likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of the hair, putting on of gold jewelry, or the clothing you wear, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves by submitting to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. So Peter makes it pretty clear that the wife's role is to submit and even to obey her husband in that in their relationship. Wives, how do you react when your husband wants to lead your family in a direction that you don't completely agree with or on board with? It's attempting to drag your heels, to delay as long as possible so that you can have as many opportunities to argue with him as you can in order to change his mind, to go the direction that you would like to go. When Abraham obeyed God, there was no delay whatsoever. I want you to notice the passage there in 1 Peter 3 that talks about how Sarah obeyed Abraham. And you're her children if you don't fear anything that's frightening. You ever thought about what that means? Have you considered what Sarah's reaction would have been like when Abraham comes into the tent after Genesis 12, 1 through 3 takes place and he says, we're leaving. We're going to pack up and we're going to take our family and we're going to move. Well, okay, where are we going? I don't know. But I had a conversation with God and we're going to move. That would have been frightening, I would imagine, to Sarah. Because her husband is leading her family in a direction that she has no idea where they're going, and yet she obeys him. But on the flip side of that, I want to make sure that we don't leave this discussion without talking to husbands, because Peter does spend time on them in verse 7. Husbands have a huge responsibility given to them by God to make sure they understand their role and the constraints that God has put on them, to make sure that they understand that they have the headship given to them by God, but it's not because they're always going to make the best decisions, not because they're smarter than their wives, not because they will always be better in their decisions than their wives will, but because God has designed the glove of family leadership to fit their hands. But we must understand our roles, and we must understand obedience. And this is a great story to give that more clarity. All right, something else about Abraham I want to talk about in chapter 21. Let's go over to Genesis 21 for a moment and look at verse 12 together. Genesis chapter 21. Let's back up just a moment to verse 8. And the child grew, talking about Isaac. He grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw that the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, laughing. So she said to Abraham, cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac. And the thing was very displeasing to Abraham on account of his son. But God said to Abraham, be not displeased because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you, for through Isaac shall your offspring be named. Abraham had a hard time with this relationship between Sarah and Hagar and Ishmael and himself. You know, he brings this woman and then has a son through her, and that comes into their relationship. And Sarah has a very clear understanding of what she would like, but Abraham seems conflicted here. Notice a couple of different translations in this scripture about verse 12. Verse 11, where it says, "The thing was very displeasing to Abraham." The New American Standard says, "The matter distressed Abraham greatly." Holman Christian says, "This was a very difficult thing for Abraham." ASV says, "The thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight." We don't get the sense that Abraham disagreed with what Sarah was saying, but still, this was his son. And this was his other wife that he had. And so he had some qualms about sending these people away into the desert. And we notice from Genesis that after he sends them away, we don't have any record of him seeing Ishmael ever again. But God gave him a command in verse 14, and that brought peace of mind, that brought resolution to this situation. And so this is a really good example for us when we think about obeying God and what that means. That obedience to what He's instructed us to do brings us peace, brings us resolution. You know, think about your life and the things in your life that are difficult for you, that you are conflicted about, that you have problems with. Maybe there's some project at work that is upcoming in the future that you are dreading. Maybe there's a problem at home that is a source of conflict in your mind about how to deal with the situation. On the one hand, you know that the problem has to be solved. Like Abraham knew that this problem had to be solved between his family members. But on the other hand, you know it's going to be a chore to somehow resolve it. What do we do about that? Well, we do what Abraham did. We listen to a command or a promise or an instruction, and we let that solve our dilemmas and bring calm to our lives. In Matthew 6, in verse 34, Jesus said this, "Therefore do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble." You know, that verse is not a suggestion. It is a command. It is something that we must do. You and I have no control over what happens in our futures. You know, I've got a calendar program in my computer that allows me to plan what my events are going to be and what I think my life is going to be like months and even years in advance, but ultimately I have no say over what happens in the months and years to come. We only have today. We can only trust today that even though we don't have the answers to future problems, God does. And He can resolve them and help us to push through whatever roadblocks that we have if we are willing to obey whatever He has instructed us to do. So I want to end this lesson by making this point, that obedience to God, as we see throughout the life of Abraham, does not bring oppression, does not bring subjugation, does not bring terrible things, as some people in the world might argue. To obey is to be a slave. To obey is to have a rod on your back. Now, to obey God brings promises. To obey God brings blessings. Even though we might not understand how they're working, even though God might lead us down paths that we might not grasp completely, we can see from His life that it turned out to be an incredible blessing. And we, because He obeyed, we are reaping the benefits of that in our lives through Jesus, because Jesus came through this man. And now all nations are blessed. And so in our relationships between husbands and wives, when obedience is there in a godly way, there are blessings. In our relationships between our children and our parents, when godly obedience is there, there are blessings. In every relationship where this is a factor, we have to remember this principle, that God's way brings us to joy and to peace. In Matthew chapter 11, verse 30, Jesus tells us that His yoke is easy and His burden is light. You know, the image of an easy yoke is a yoke that fits right on the oxen or whatever animal that yoke is on. And that's the idea of that passage, that Jesus' yoke fits on our souls in just the right way so that we can do what we were designed to be and to do. But Satan is a cruel master, and his yoke is anything but light and anything but easy. And so if you are still under his yoke this morning, I would strongly urge you to think seriously about throwing it off and accepting a new yoke and a new master. And yes, God calls you to obedience, to live a submissive life to Him, but He also promises you, just like He promised Abraham, that if you will accept the call to obey Him, He's got a store of blessings waiting to pour out on you. You want those blessings, if you want the peace and joy that comes only through God's Son, then please let us help you with that, whatever spiritual need that you have, as together we stand up and we sing the song of invitation together.